detectives. And down to the parlour I forthwith softly trotted, for I thought, if I jumped off the mantelpiece whilst in full spread, sir, the air I trapped in my feathers would itself sustain me off the ground. At first sight, you'd have thought that this drawing-room was the smoking-room of a gentleman's club of the utmost exclusivity, for Nelson encouraged an almost lugubrious degree of masculine good behaviour amongst her clients. She went in for leather armchairs and tables with the Times on them that Liz ironed every morning, and the walls, covered with wine-red figured damask, were hung with oil paintings of mythological subjects so crusted with age that the painted scenes within the heavy golden frame seemed full of the honey of ancient sunlight, and it had crystallised the former sweet scab. All these pictures, some of the Venetian school, and no doubt very choice, were long since destroyed, along with Ma Nelson's house itself. But there was one picture I shall always remember, for it is as if engraved upon my heart. It hung above the mantelpiece, and I need hardly tell you that its subject was Leda and the Swan. All those who saw her picture gallery wondered, but Nelson would never have her pictures cleaned. She always said, didn't she, Liz, that Time himself, the father of transfigurations, was the greatest of artists, and his invisible hand must be respected at all costs, since it was in anonymous complicity with that of every human painter. So I always saw, as through a glass darkly, what might have been my own primal scene, my own conception, the heavenly bird in a white majesty of feathers, descending with imperious desire upon the half-stunned, and yet herself impassioned girl. When I asked Ma Nelson what this picture meant, she told me it was a demonstration of the blinding access of the grace of flesh. With this remarkable statement, she gave Walter a sideways, cunning glance from under eyelashes a little darker than her hair. Curiouser and curiouser, thought Walter. A one-eyed metaphysical madame in Whitechapel, in possession of a Titian. Shall I believe it? Shall I pretend to believe in it? Some bloke, whose name I misremember. Give her the pictures, said Lizzie. He liked her on account of how she shaved her pubes. Feathers gave Lizzie a disapproving glance, but spoiled the effect by giggling. Lizzie now crouched at Feather's feet, using her own handbag as a footstool, her huge handbag, an affair of cracked leather with catches of discoloured brass. Her hooked chin rested on the knees she clasped with liver-spotted hands. She crackled quietly with her own static. She missed nothing. The watchdog? Or might it be possible? Could it be? And Walser found himself asking himself, are they, in reality, mother and daughter? Yet if this was so, what Nordic giant feathered the one upon the swarthy tiny other? And who or where in all this business was the Svengali who turned the girl into a piece of artifice, who had made of her a marvellous machine and equipped her with her story? Had the one-eyed whore, if she existed, been the first business manager of these weird accomplices? He turned a page in his notebook. Imagine me, sir, tripping in nothing but Ma Nelson's shawl into that drawing-room where the shutters were bolted tight, the crimson velvet curtains drawn, all still simulating the dark night of pleasure, although the candles were burnt out in the crystal sconces. Last night's fragrant fire was but charred sticks in the hearth, and glasses in which remained only the flat dregs of dissipation lay where they had fallen on the Bacara carpet. The flimsy light of the farthing dip I carried with me touched the majesty of the swan god on the wall and made me dream. Dream and dare. Well grown though I was, yet I had to pull a chair to the mantelpiece in order to climb up and take down the French gilt clock that stood there in a glass case. This clock was, you might say, the sign or signifier of Ma Nelson's little private realm. It was a figure of Father Time with a scythe in one hand and a skull in the other, above a face on which the hand stood always at either midnight or noon, the minute hand and the hour hand folded perpetually together, as if in prayer. For Ma Nelson said the clock in her reception room must show the dead centre of the day or night, the shadowless hour, the hour of vision and revelation, the still hour in the centre of the storm of time. She was a strange one, Ma Nelson. Walser could well believe it. I picked up the old clock to give me some room to move and set it down with care by the disordered hearth. As I did so, the antique defunct mechanism let out a faint melodious twang, as if resounding with clockwork encouragement. Then I climbed up and stood where Father Time had stood, and like a man about to hang himself, I kicked away the chair so that I would not be tempted to jump down upon it. What a long way down the floor looked. It was only a few feet below, you understand, no great distance in itself, yet it yawned before me like a chasm. And indeed, you might say that this gulf now before me represented the grand abyss, the poignant divide, that would henceforth separate me from common humanity. At that, she turned her immense eyes upon him. Those eyes, made for the stage, whose messages could be read from standing room in the gods. Night had darkened their colour. Their irises were now purple, matching the palmer violets in front of her mirror, and the pupils had grown so fat on darkness that the entire dressing room and all those within it could have vanished without trace inside those compelling voids. Walser felt the strangest sensation, as if these eyes of the aerialiste were a pair of sets of Chinese boxes, as if each one opened into a world, into a world, into a world, an infinite plurality of worlds, and these unguessable depths exercised the strongest possible attraction, so that he felt himself trembling, as if he, too, stood on an unknown threshold. Surprised by his own confusion, he gave his mind a quick shake to refresh its pragmatism. She lowered her eyelids, as if she knew enough was enough, and took a sip of now flat champagne, before she continued. Her eyes reverted once again to the simple condition of a pair of blue eyes. I stood upon the mantelpiece, and I gave a little shiver, for it was perishing cold in there before Lizzie lit the fire, and the carpet looked further away than ever. But then, thinks I, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And behind me, truly, sir, upon the wall. I could have sworn I heard, caught in time's cobweb, but all the same audible, the strenuous beating of great white wings. So I spread, and closing my eyes, I precipitated myself forward, throwing myself entirely upon the mercy of gravity. She fell silent for a moment, and Ranald the dirty satin stretched over her knees with her fingernail. And, sir, I fell. Like Lucifer I fell, down, down, down I tumbled, bang with a bump on the Persian rug below me, flat on my face amongst those blooms and beasts that never grace no natural forest, those creatures of dream and abstraction not unlike myself, Mr. Walser. And then I knew I was not yet ready to bear on my back the great burden of my unnaturalness. She paused for precisely 3 heartbeats. I fell, and give my poor nose such a whack on the brass fire guard. And so I found her, when I come in to make up the fire, bum in the air and her little blonde wing still fluttering, poor duck. And I thought she'd taken such a tumble and near busted her nose in half, and oh, how it was bleeding! Not one cry did she utter. Not one. Brave little thing that she was. Nor did she shed a single tear. What did I care about my bloody nose, sir? Cried Feathers passionately. For one brief moment, one lapse or stutter of time so fleeting that the old French clock, had it been in motion, could never have recorded it on its clumsy cogs and springs, for just the smallest instant, no longer than the briefest flutter of a butterfly, I'd hovered. Yes, hovered. Only for so short a while, I could almost have thought I'd imagined it, for it was that sensation that comes to us sometimes on the edge of sleep. And yet, sir, for however short a while, the air had risen up beneath my adolescent wings and denied to me the downward pull of the great round world to which hitherto all human things had necessarily clung.
"Since I was the housekeeper," interjected Lizzie,
"happily, I carried all the keys of the house in a ring on my belt, and when I comes chinking into the parlour with my armful of sandalwood, I had the remedy for her bloody nose to hand. I slapped the front door key between her wings. It was a foot long and cold as hell. The flow stopped from shock. Then I mops her up with my apron and takes her down to the kitchen in the warm, wraps her up in a blanket and anoints her abrasions with germaline, slaps on a bit of sticking plaster here and there, and when she's as good as new, she tells her Lizzie all about the peculiar sensation she felt when she launched herself off the mantelpiece.
And I was full of wonder, sir. But though now I knew I could mount on the air, and it would hold me up, the method of the act of flight itself was unknown to me. As babies needs must learn to walk, so must I needs learn to conquer the alien element, and not only did I need to know the power of the limitations of my feathery limbs, but I must study too the airy medium that was henceforth to be my second home, as he who would a mariner be needs to construe the mighty currents, the tides and whirlpools, all the whims and moods and conflicting temperaments of the watery parts of the world. I learnt first, as the birds do, from the birds. All this took place in the first part of spring, towards the end of the month of February, when the birds were just waking from their winter lethargy. A spring brought out the buds on the daffodils in our window boxes. So the London pigeons started up their courtships, the male puffing out his bosom and strutting after the female in his comic fashion. And so it happened that the pigeons built a nest upon the pediment outside our attic window and laid their eggs in it. When the wee pidgeys hatched out, Lizzie and I watched them with more care than you can conceive of. We saw how the mother pigeon taught her babies to totter along the edge of the wall, observed in the minutest detail how she gave them mute instructions to use those aerial arms of theirs, their joints, their wrists, their elbows, to imitate those actions of her own, which were, in fact, I realised, not dissimilar to those of a human swimmer. But do not think I carried out these studies on my own. Although she was flightless herself, my Lizzie took it upon herself the role of bird mother. In those quiet hours of the afternoon, while the friends and sisters that we lived with bent over their books, Lizzie constructed a graph on squared paper in order to account for the great difference in weight between a well-formed human female in her 14th year and a tiny pigeonlet, so that we should know to what height I might soar without tempting the fate of Icarus. All this while, as the months passed, I grew bigger and stronger. Stronger and bigger, until Liz was forced to put aside her mathematics in order to make me an entire new set of dresses to accommodate the remarkable development of my upper body.
I'll say this for Ma Nelson. She paid up all expenses on the nail out of pure love of our little kitty. And what's more, she thought up the scheme how we should put it round. She was an hunchback. Yes.
Yes, indeed, sir. Every night I mimicked the winged victory in the drawing-room niche, and was the cynosure of all eyes. But Nelson made it known that those shining golden wings of mine were stuck over a hump with a strong adhesive and did not belong to me at all, so I was spared the indignity of curiosity. And though I now began to receive many, many offers for first bite at the cherry, offers running into four figures, sir, yet Nelson refused them all, for fear of letting the cat out of the bag.
"She was a proper lady," said Lizzie. "Nelson was a good'un, she was."
"She was," concurred Feathers. "She had the one peculiarity, sir, due to her sobriquet or nickname. She always dressed in the full dress uniform of an admiral of the fleet. Not that she ever missed a trick, her one eye sharp as a needle, and always used to say, 'I'll keep a tight little ship.' Her ship of battle, though, sometimes she'd laugh and say, 'It was a pirate ship, and went under false colours.' Her bark of pleasure that was moored, of all unlikely places, in the sluggish Thames." Lizzie fixed Walser with her glittering eyes and seized the narrative between her teeth.
It was from the, as it were, topsail or crow's nest of this barge that my girl made her first ascent. And this is how it came about. Imagine my surprise one bright June morning as I watched my pigeon family with my customary diligence to see as one of the little creatures teetered on the brink of the pediment, looking for all the world like a swimmer debating with himself as to whether the water was warm enough for him. Why, as it dithered there, its loving mother came right up behind it and shoved it clean off the edge. First, it dropped like a stone so that my heart sank with it and I let out a mournful cry, but almost before that cry left my lips, all its lessons must have rushed back into its little head at once, for suddenly it soared upwards towards the sun with a flash of white unfurled wing and was never seen no more. So I says to Feathers, "Nothing to it, my dear, but your Liz must shove you off the roof."
"To me?" said Feathers. It seemed that Lizzie, by proposing thus to thrust me into the free embrace of the whirling air, was arranging my marriage to the wind itself.
She swung round on her piano stool and presented Walser with a face of such bridal radiance that he blinked.
"Yes, I must be the bride of that wild, sightless, fleshless rover, or else could not exist, sir. Nelson's house was some 5 stories high, and there was a neat little garden at the back of it that went down to the river. There was a trapdoor leading to a loft in the ceiling of our attic, and another trapdoor in the ceiling of the loft that gave directly on the roof itself. So, one night in June, or rather early morning, about 4 or 5, a night without a moon, for like sorceresses we required the dark and privacy for our doings, out on the tiles crawls Lizzie and her apprentice."
"Midsummer," said Lizzie. "Either Midsummer's night, or else very early on Midsummer's morning. Don't you remember, darling?"
"Midsummer, yes. The year's Greenhinge. Yes, Liz, I remember."
Pause of a single heartbeat.
"The business of the house was over. The last cab had rolled away with the last customer too poor to stay the night, and all behind the drawn curtains were at long last sleeping. Even those thieves, cutthroats and night prowlers who stalked the mean streets about us had gone home to their beds, either pleased with their prey or not, depending on their luck. It seemed a hush of expectation filled the city, that all was waiting in an exquisite tension of silence for some unparalleled event."
"She, although it was a chilly night, had not a stitch on her, for we feared that any item of clothing might impede the lively movement of the body. Out onto the tiles we crawled, and the little wind that lives in high places came and prowled around the chimneys. It was soft, cool weather, and my pretty one came out in goose flesh, didn't you? Such shivering. The roof had only a gentle slope on it, so we crawled down to the gutter, from which side of the house we could see old Father Thames shining like black oilcloth wherever the bobbing mooring lights of the watermen touched him.
Now it came to it, I was seized with a great fear. Not only a fear that we might discover the hard way that my wings were as those of the hen, or as the vestigial appendages of the ostrich, that these wings were in themselves a kind of physical deceit, intended for show and not for use, like beauty in some women, sir. No, I was not afraid only because the morning light already poking up the skirt of the sky might find me, when its fingers tickled the house, lying only a bag of broken bone in Ma Nelson's garden. Mingled with the simple fear of physical harm, there was a strange terror in my bosom that made me cling at the last gasp of time to Lizzie's skirts and beg her to abandon our project, for I suffered the greatest conceivable terror of the irreparable difference with which success in the attempt would mark me. I feared a wound not of the body, but the soul, sir, an irreconcilable division between myself and the rest of humankind. I feared the proof of my own singularity. Yet if it could speak, would not any wise child cry out from the womb, 'Keep me in the darkness here, keep me warm, keep me in contingency'? But nature will not be denied.
So this young creature cried out to me that she would not be what she must become, and though her pleading moved me until tears blinded my own eyes, I knew that what will be must be, and so I pushed.
The transparent arms of the wind received the virgin. As I hurtled past the windows of the attic in which I passed those precious white nights of girlhood, so the wind came up beneath my outspread wings, and with a jolt, I found myself hanging in midair, and the garden lay beneath me like the board of a marvellous game and stayed where it was. The earth did not rise up to meet me. I was secure in the arms of my invisible lover. But the wind did not relish my wandering inactivity for long. Slowly, slowly, while I depended from him, numb with amazement, he, as if affronted by my passivity, started to let me slip through his fingers, and I commenced once more upon the fearful fall, until my lessons came back to me, and I kicked up with my heels that I had learned from the birds to keep tight together to form a rudder for this little boat, my body, this little boat that could cast anchor in the clouds. So I kicked up with my heels, and then, as if I were a swimmer, brought the longest and most flexible of my wingtip feathers together over my head. Then, with long, increasingly confident strokes, I parted them and brought them back together. Yes, that was the way to do it. Yes! I clapped my wingtips together again, 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 and the wind loved that and clasped me to his bosom once more, so I found I could progress in tandem with him just as I pleased, and so cut a corridor through the invisible liquidity of the air.
Is there another bowl left, Lizzie? Lizzie scraped off fresh foil and filled up all their glasses. Feathers drank thirstily, and poured herself another with a not altogether steady hand.
"Don't excite yourself, Gil,"
said Lizzie gently. Feather's chin jerked up at that, almost pettishly.
"Oh, Lizzie, the gentleman must know the truth."
And she fixed Walser with a piercing, judging regard, as if to ascertain just how far she could go with him. Her face, in its Brobdingnagian symmetry, might have been hacked from wood, and brightly painted up by those artists who built carnival ladies for fairgrounds or figureheads for sailing ships. It flickered through his mind. Is she really a man? A creaking and wheezing outside the door heralded a bang upon it. The old night watchman in his leather cape.
What? Still here, Miss Feathers? Excuse me. It's all the light under the crack, see?
We're entertaining the press, said Feathers. Won't be long now, me old duck. Have a drop of bubbly.
She overflowed her glass and shoved it across to him. He downed it at a gulp and smacked his lips.
Just the job. You know where to find me if there's any trouble, miss.
Feathers darted Walser an ironic glance under her lashes and smiled at the departing night watchman as if to say,
Don't you think I'd be a match for him?
Lizzie continued,
Imagine. With what joy, pride, and wonder, I watch my darling, naked as a star, vanish round the corner of the house. And to tell the truth, I was most heartily relieved, too, for in our hearts we both knew it was a do-or-die attempt.
But hadn't I dared and done, sir?
Feathers broke in. For this first flight of mine, I did no more than circle the house at a level that just topped the cherry tree in Nelson's garden, which was some 30 feet high.
And in spite of the great perturbation of my senses and the excess of mental concentration the practice of my newfound skill required, I did not neglect to pick my Lizzie a handful of the fruit that had just reached perfect ripeness upon the topmost branches, fruit that customarily we were forced to leave as a little tribute for the thrushes. No person in the deserted street to see me or think I was some hallucination or waking dream or phantom of the gin shop fumes. I successfully made the circumnavigation of the house, and then, aglow with triumph, I soared upwards to the roof again to rejoin my friend. But now, unused as they were to so much exercise, my wings began, oh,
God! To give out! For going up involves an altogether different set of cogs and pulleys than coming down, sir. Although I did not know that then. Our studies in comparative physiology were yet to come. So I leaps up, much as a dolphin leaps, which I now know is not the way to do it. In having already misjudged how high I should leap in the first place, my weary wings already folding up beneath me. My heart misses. I think my first flight will be my last, and I shall pay with my life the price of my hubris. Scattering the cherries I had gathered in a soft black hail over the garden, I grabbed at the guttering, and oh, and all, the guttering gave way beneath me. The old lead parted company with the eaves with a groaning sigh, and there I dangled all complete woman again, my wings having seized up in perfect terror of a human fate. But I reached out and gripped her by the arms. Only love, great love, could have given me such strength, sir, to permit me to haul her in onto the roof against the pull of gravity as you might haul in against the tide a drowning person. And there we huddled on the roof in one another's arms, sobbing together with mingled joy and relief as dawn rose over London and gilded the great dome of St. Paul's until it looked like the divine pap of the city, which, for want of any other, I needs must call my natural mother. London, with the one breast, the Amazon Queen. She fell silent. Some object within the room, perhaps the hot water pipes, gave out a metallic tinkle. Lizzie, on her creaking handbag, shifted from one buttock to the other and coughed. Feathers remained sunk in introspection for a while, and the wind blew Big Ben, striking midnight, so lost, so lonely a sound it seemed to Walser the clock might be striking in a deserted city, and they the only inhabitants left alive. Although he was not an imaginative man, even he was sensitive to that aghast time of the night when the dark dwarfs us. The final reverberation of the chimes died away. Feathers heaved a sigh that rocked the surface of her satin bosom and came out of her lapse of vivacity. Let me tell you a little more about my work in life at this time. What it was I got up to when I was not flitting about the sky like a bat, sir. You will recall how I stood in for the winged victory each night in the parlour, and may have wondered how this might have been, since I have arms. And she stretched them out, spanning half the dressing room in the process. And the winged victory has none. Well, Ma Nelson put it out that I was the perfection of, the original of, the very model for that statue, which, in its broken and incomplete state, has teased the imagination of a brace of millennia, with its promise of perfect active beauty that has been, as it were, mutilated by history. Ma Nelson, contemplating the existence of my two arms, all complete, now puts her mind to the question. What might the winged victory have been holding in them, when the forgotten master first released her from the marble that had contained her inexhaustible spirit? And Ma Nelson soon came up with the answer. A sword. So she equipped me with a very gilt ceremonial sword that come with her admiral's uniform, that she used to wear at her side, and sometimes used as a staff with which to conduct the revels, her wand like Prospero's. And now I grasped that sword in my right hand, with a point downwards to show I meant no harm unless provoked, whilst my left hand hung loosely at my side, the fist clenched. How was I costumed for my part? My hair was powdered white with chalk and tied up with a ribbon, and my wings were powdered white too, so I let out a puff if touched. My face and the top off of my body was spread with a wet white that clowns use in the circus, and I had white drapes from my navel to my knee, but my shins and feet were dipped in wet white too. "And very lovely she looked," cried loyal Lizzie. Feathers modestly lowered her eyelashes. "Lovely or not, Ma Nelson always expressed complete satisfaction with my turnout and soon took to calling me not her winged victory, but her victory with wings, the spiritual flagship of her fleet, as if a virgin with a weapon was the fittest guardian angel for a house full of holes. Yet it may be that a large woman with a sword is not the best advertisement for a brothel, for slow but sure, trade fell off from my 14th birthday on. Not not so much that of our faithfulest clients, those old rakes who perhaps Ma Nelson had herself initiated in the far-off days of their beardless and precipitously ejaculatory youth, and others who might have formed such particular attachments to Annie or to Grace, that you could speak of a kind of marriage there. No, such gentlemen could not shift the habits of a lifetime. Ma Nelson had addicted them to those shadowless hours of noon and midnight, the clarity of bought pleasure, the simplicity of contract, as it was celebrated in her aromatic parlour. These were the kind of old buffers who would extend a father's indulgence in the shape of the odd half-sovereign or string of seed pearls to the half-woman, half-statue they had known in those earliest days when she had played Cupid, and sometimes out of childish fun, sprung off her toy arrows amongst them, hitting in play, sometimes an ear, sometimes a buttock, sometimes a bollock. But with their sons and grandsons, it was a different matter. When the time came for them to meet La Nelson and her girls, in they trot, timorous yet defiant, blushing to the tops of their eaten collars, a quiver with nervous anticipation and dread, and then their eyes would fall on the sword I held, and Louisa or Emily would have the devil's own job with them thereafter. I put it down to the influence of Baudelaire, sir. "What's this?" cried Walser, amazed enough to drop his professional imperturbability. "The French poet, sir. A poor fellow who loved whores not for the pleasure of it, but, as he perceived it, the horror of it. As if we was not working women doing it for money, but damn souls who did it solely to lure men to their dooms, as if we'd got nothing better to do. Yet we were all suffragists in that house. Oh, Nelson was a one for votes for women, I can tell you. That seems strange to you, that the caged bird should want to see the end of cages, sir? Queried Lizzie, with an edge of steel in her voice. Let me tell you that it was a wholly female world within Ma Nelson's door. Even the dog who guarded it was a bitch. And all the cats were females, one or other of them always in kitten or newly given birth, so that a subtext of fertility underwrote the glittering sterility of the pleasure of the flesh available within the academy. Life within those walls was governed by a sweet and loving reason. I never saw a single blow exchanged between any of the sisterhood who reared me, nor heard a cross word or a voice raised in anger. Until the hour of eight, when work began and Lizzie stationed herself behind the peephole in the front door, the girls kept to their rooms, and the benign silence might be interrupted only by the staccato rattle of the typewriter as Grace practised her stenography, or the lyric ripple of the flute upon which Esmeralda was proving to be something of a virtuoso. But what followed after they put away their books was only poor girls earning a living. For though some of the customers would swear the whores do it for pleasure, that is only to ease their own consciences, so that they will feel less foolish when they fork out hard cash for pleasure that has no real existence unless given freely. Oh, indeed! We knew we only sold the simulacra. No woman would turn her belly to the trade unless pricked by economic necessity, sir. As for myself, I'll work my passage on Ma Nelson's ship as living statue, and during my blossoming years, from 14 to 17... I existed only as an object in men's eyes after the night-time knocking on the door began. Such was my apprenticeship for life, since is it not to the mercies of the eyes of others that we commit ourselves on our voyage through the world? I was as if closed up in a shell, for the wet white would harden on my face and torso like a death mask that covered me all over, yet inside this appearance of marble, nothing could have been more vibrant with potentiality than I. Sealed in this artificial egg, this sarcophagus of beauty. I waited. Although I could not have told you for what it was I waited. Except I assure you, I did not await the kiss of a magic prince, sir. With my two eyes I nightly saw how such a kiss would seal me up in my appearance forever. Yet I was possessed by the idea I had been feathered out for some special fate, that what it was I could not imagine. So I waited with lithic patience for that destiny to manifest itself. "As I wait now, sir," she said directly to Walser, swinging round to him, as the last cobwebs of the old century blow away. Then she swung back to the mirror and thoughtfully tucked away a straying curl.
However, until Liz opened the door and let the men in, when all we girls needs must jump to attention and behave like women, you might say that in our well-ordered habitation all was luxe, calme et volupté. Though not quite as the poet imagined. You all engage in our intellectual, artistic or political, here Lizzie coughed, pursuits. And as for myself, those long hours of leisure I devoted to the study of aerodynamics and the physiology of flight in Ma Nelson's library, from among whose abundant store of books I gleaned whatever small store of knowledge I possess, sir.
With that, she batted her eyelashes at Walser in the mirror. From the pale length of those eyelashes, a good 3 inches, he might have thought she had not taken her false ones off, had he not been able to see them lolling, hairy as gooseberries, among the formidable refuse of the dressing-table. He continued to take notes in a mechanical fashion, but as the women unfolded the convolutions of their joint stories together, he felt more and more like a kitten tangling up in a ball of wool it had never intended to unravel in the first place, or a sultan faced with not one but 2 Scheherazades, both intent on impacting 1,000 stories into the single night.
"Library?" he queried, indefatigably, if a touch wearily.
"He left it to her," said Lizzie.
"Who left what to whom?"
"This old geezer. F. Nelson his library, on account of she was the only woman in London who could get it up for him."
"Lizzie! You know I abhor coarse language."
"And that in spite of, or perhaps because of, her black eye patch and her travesty. Oh, her little plump thighs like chicken cutlets in her doeskin breeches. What a quaint figure she cut. He was a Scottish gentleman with a big beard, I remember him well. Never give his name, of course. Left her his library. Our Feathers was always rooting about in it. Nose in a book, nothing but a poke of humbugs for company."
"Humbugs," noted Walser, with renewed enthusiasm.
"In England, a kind of candy. In America..."
"As to my flight," continued Feathers inexorably, "you must realise that my size, weight and general construction were not such as to make flying come easy to me, although there is ample room in my chest for lungs of the size required. But the bones of birds are filled with air, and mine are filled with solid marrow, and if the remarkable development of my thorax forms the same kind of windbreak as does that of a pigeon, the resemblance stops abruptly there, and problems of balance and of elementary negotiations with the wind, who is a fickle lover, absorbed me for a long time. Have you observed my legs, sir?" She thrust her right leg through the flap of her dressing-gown. Its foot wore a down-at-heel pink velvet slipper, trimmed with grubby swan's down. The leg itself, perfectly bare, was admirably long and lean. "My legs don't tally with the upper part of my body from the point of view of pure aesthetics, d'ye see? There ought to be the true copy of Venus, one built on my scale, ought to have legs like tree trunks, sir. These flimsy little underpinnings of mine have more than once buckled under the top-heavy distribution of weight upon my torso, have let me down with a bump and left me sprawling. I'm not tip-top where walking is concerned, sir. More tip-up. Any bird of my dimensions would have little short legs it could tuck up under itself, and so make of itself a flying wedge to pierce the air. But old Spindleshanks here ain't fitted out like neither bird nor woman down below. Discussing this problem with Lizzie..."
"I suggested a Sunday afternoon trip to the Zoological Gardens, where we saw the storks, the cranes and the flamingos."
"And these long-stemmed creatures gave me the giddy promise of protracted flight, which I had thought was to be denied me. For the cranes cross continents, do they not? They winter in Africa and summer on the Baltic. I vowed I'd learn to swoop and soar, to emulate at last the albatross, and glide with delighted glee on the roaring 40s and furious 50s, those winds like the breath of hell that guard the white southern pole. For as my legs grew, so did my wingspan.
and my ambition swelled to match both.
I should never be content with short hops to Hackney Marshes. Cockney Sparrow I might be by birth, but not by inclination. I saw my future as criss-crossing the globe, for then I knew nothing of the constraints the world imposes. I only knew my body was the abode of limitless freedom. For starters, needs must be content with small beginnings, sir. To climb onto the roof on moonless nights, nobody there to see, and take off for secret flights above the slumbering city. Some early tests we found we could conduct in our own front room as the vertical take-off.
Lizzie repeated, as if a lesson from a book. When the bird wishes to soar upwards suddenly, it lowers its elbows after it has produced the impetus.
Feathers pushed back her chair, rose up on tiptoe, and lifted towards the ceiling a face which suddenly bore an expression of the most heavenly beatitude, face of an angel in a Sunday school picture book. A remarkable transformation. She crossed her arms on her massive bust, and the bulge in the back of her satin dressing gown began to heave and bubble. Cracks appeared in the old satin. Everything appeared to be about to burst out and take off. But the loose curls quivering on top of her high-piled chignon already brushed a stray drifting cobweb from the smoke-discoloured ceiling, and Lizzie warned,
"Not enough room in here, love. You'll have to leave it to his imagination. Nelson's drawing-room was twice as high as this rotten attic, and our girlie wasn't half as tall then as she is now. Shot up like anything when you were 17, didn't you, darling?"
Oh, the caress in her voice.
Feathers reluctantly subsided on her stool, and a brooding shadow crossed her brow.
"Then I was 17.
And then our bad years started. Our years in the wilderness."
She heaved another volcanic sigh.
"Any of that fizz left, Liz?"
Lizzie peeked behind the screen.
"Would you believe we've drunk a lot?"
Abandoned bottles rolling underfoot among the fetid lingerie gave the room a debauched look.
"Well, then, make us a cup of tea, there's a love."
Lizzie ducked behind the screen and emerged with a tin kettle.
"I'll just trot off and fill it up at the tap in the corridor."
Alone with a marvellous giantess, Walser saw the undercurrent of suspicion towards himself she had partially concealed during the interview now come to the surface. Her geniality evaporated. She squinted at him beneath her thick, pale lashes with almost hostility, seemed ill at ease, reached out to toy with her bunch of violets in a bored fashion. Something somewhere, perhaps the tin lid of the tin kettle, rattled and clanged. She cocked her head. Then the chimes of Big Ben came drifting towards them once again, on the soundless night, and all at once she was imbued with vivacity.
12 o'clock already. Our time does fly when one is babbling on about oneself.
For the first time that night, Walser was seriously discomposed.
"Yeah, hey there. Didn't that clock strike midnight just a while ago, after the night watchman came round?" "Did it, sir? How could it have, sir?" "Oh, dear, no, sir. Didn't it go 10, 11, 12, just this very minute? Didn't we both sit here and hear it? Look at your own watch, sir, if you don't believe me."
Walter obediently checked his fob. It clasped its hands at midnight. He put it to his ear, where it ticked away industriously in the usual fashion. Lizzie returned bearing a dripping kettle. The dressing room was fully equipped for making tea. There was a brass spirit stove in the cupboard beside the fireplace, and a Japan tray on which lived a chubby brown teapot and thick white pot mugs. Lizzie set a match to the small flame and reached in the cupboard again for a blue bag of sugar and for milk.
"Off again," she observed, peering within the jug.
"We'll have to have our tea black, then."
"Well, maybe my ears deceived me,"
Walter murmured, as he slipped his fob back in his breast pocket.
"What's this?"
pricked sharp-eared Lizzie.
"He thinks we put Big Ben back an hour," said Feathers, with a straight face.
"Very likely,"
said Lizzie contemptuously.
"Oh, very like."
Feathers had a powerfully sweet tooth. She dispensed with measures and tipped the sugar into her steaming mug directly from the bag. In a stream. warming her hands on its side. For whatever time it was the chill of night. Feathers began again. Her voice. It was as if Walter had become a prisoner of her voice. Her cavernous, somber voice. A voice made for shouting about the tempest. Her voice of a celestial fishwife. Musical as it strangely was, yet not a voice for singing with. It comprised discords. Her scale contained 12 tones. Her voice with its warped, homely, cockney vowels and random aspirates. Her dark, rusty, dipping, swooping voice, imperious as a siren's. Yet such a voice could almost have had its source not within her throat, but in some ingenious mechanism or other behind the canvas screen, voice of a fake medium at a seance. Ma Nelson met her end with terrible suddenness, for slipping on some foreign matter, skin of a fruit or dog turd, as she was crossing Whitechapel High Street on her way to Bloom's to treat us all to salt beef sandwiches, she fell beneath the oncoming hooves and wheels of a brewer's dray and was mangled to pulp in a trice. Dead on arrival at hospital, poor old thing. Chimed in Lizzie like a cracked bell. No chance for even so much as a kiss me hardy, nor any tender final words like that. We give her a lovely funeral. Black plumes and mutes with chiffon toppers, sir. Whitechapel ain't never seen such a sight before or since. The cortege followed by droves of grieving oars. But as we were breaking a funeral baked meat or two amongst ourselves back in the parlour after our beloved old girl was laid to rest, comes a knocking at the door like Judgment Day. And Judgment Day indeed it proved to be, sir. For who should I let in but a dissenting cleric, his dog-collar up to his ears and his gnashing teeth and crying, "Let the wages of sin pay for the good Lord's work!" Now Nelson, being taken from us so sudden when she herself was in the prime of life not much older than my Lizzie is now, had not thought to make a will, although she thought of us as her adopted daughters, and yet she could not bear to think of death either. So dying intestate as she did, all her estate went by due process of the law to this her surviving kin. To all the irony of fate, that very stern and stony-hearted elder brother who cast her from his hearth when as a girl first she slipped, and so ensured her ruin in one sense, although her fortune in another. Is there no justice in either earth or heaven? It would seem not. For this very same cruel, unnatural brother now arrived legally entitled to beggar her posthumously, and if we had not already paid for her gravestone out of the petty cash, we chose safe harbour for the epitaph. He'd have seen to it that good, kind, decent woman returned to the earth out of which he had been formed without so much as a pebble to mark her passage. He couldn't stand the sight of her sitting there, eating food he thought belonged to him. He overturned the pork pies and spilled on the carpets all Ma Nelson's vintage port that we had broken out. Announces he, "Our time is up. He gives us till 9 o'clock next morning," such was the goodness of his heart, "to pack ourselves up, bag and baggage, and make ourselves scarce. Leave the only home we knew. Go out on the common." In this way he planned to cleanse the temple of the ungodly. Although he was kind enough to hint that his God might smile at any of us who cared to repent and stay on because with a singular poetic justice, he intended to make of his inheritance a hostel for fallen girls, and he thought a repentant harlot or two would come in handy about the place. Poacher turned gamekeeper, you might say. But not one of us would take up the wardress posts he offered. No, thank you. After he departed in a growler back to his manse in Deptford, we held a council amongst ourselves as to our futures, which we foresaw would no longer be held in common. Oh, we grieved that this should be. Yet the necessity that first united us must now drive us apart. And so we bowed to necessity, as all of us must do, although the invisible bonds of affection would always knit us wherever we roamed. But the unexpected did not find our friends altogether unprepared. You will recall how Ma Nelson knew that the days of the grand old whorehouse were numbered, and always urged the members of her academy to prepare themselves for a wider world. Louisa and Emily had formed that kind of close attachment to one another, as often reconciles women of the profession to its rigours, and long before Ma Nelson passed away, had decided between them to retire early, after having saved sufficient to set themselves up in a little boarding house in Brighton, They'd long cherished the plan, and often whiled away the hours of toil while some dirty bugger poked away at them with his incompetent instrument, by planning whether their pillowcases should be left plain or edged with lace, and what wallpaper to put in the dining room. Although the sudden termination of our contracts forced these resourceful girls to start out on their adventures with somewhat less capital than they could have wished, they forthwith consulted their bank books and vowed, "Nothing ventured, nothing gained," and went upstairs to pack their trunks immediately, to leave next day for the South Coast and start their search for a suitable, modest property.
Annie and Grace had also set by a little store between them, now elected to pool it in order to start up a small agency for typing and office work, for Grace could rattle away on those keys of hers like the best of castanets, and Annie had such a head for figures, she'd been keeping Ma Nelson's account straight for years. So they, too, packed up their things and next day would move out to lodgings and set about finding suitable premises. I'm glad to say those girls have prospered too, sir, by dint of hard work and good management.
As for our Jenny, although she was the prettiest and best-hearted harlot ever trod Piccadilly, she had no special talent to put to work for her, and never saved a penny but give it all to beggars. Her sole capital was her skin alone, and what with the funeral and the eviction notice and a drop too much of Ma Nelson's port, she fell a-weeping, "What will become of me?" For she'd no heart to go it alone, after the security and companionship of the Academy. As we were comforting her and drying her eyes, comes a rat-a-tat-tat on the door knocker, and lo and behold, it's the telegraph boy. And what have the twanging wires brought her? Why, a husband, for the message reads, "One death brings on another, or so they say, and my wife just dropped anchor in the same port as the Admiral." He always called Ma Nelson the Admiral. "Jennifer Gentle, be mine in sight of Gordon, man." Signed, "Lord Muck," interpolated Lizzie, with a leaden and ironic discretion. "Lord Muck," agreed Feathers reflectively. "So let us call him, for you'd be very much surprised, sir, if I told you his name, and you looked him up in Burke's peerage. Now, as they say, no two deaths without a third follows. Well, married they were, and a very refined affair it was in St. John's, Smith Square, she in off-white, because he'd given out she is a provincial widow, and afterwards at the reception, which was held in the Savoy Hotel, nothing but the best."
"He chokes to death on the bomb surprise," said Lizzie,
and emitted a sudden fierce cackle, for which Feathers reproved her with a look. "So, she comes into 30,000 a year, a place up in Yorkshire, another in Scotland, and a very nice house in Eaton Square into the bargain. And our little duck would have been sitting pretty, except she was a sentimental soul, and grieved a good deal over the departed, as, ever the optimist, she'd counted on a long and happy life with the old bugger."
"Only a whore,"
opined Lizzie with sudden force,
"could hope for so much from marriage."
Black did become our Jenny, as she is red-headed, and in her mourning she decided to take herself off to Monte Carlo, to have a bit of a flutter at the tables, it being November and bad weather at home, and if she'd a weakness it was gambling. So she's sitting at the tables in black, Byworth, wearing only the most reticently widowed of her diamonds,
when she catches the eye of a gentleman from Chicago who makes sewing machines.
"You don't mean," interjected Walser.
"Indeed."
Walser tapped his teeth with his pencil tip, faced with the dilemma of the first checkable fact they'd offered him, and the impossibility of checking it. "Cable Mrs. the third, and ask her if she'd ever worked in a brothel run by a one-eyed whore named Nelson. Contracts had been taken out for less." Feathers and Lizzie now sighed in unison.
"However, I understand this husband number two ain't feeling any too chipper these days. Poor girl. One wonders," Lizzie intoned, poker-faced, "whether all his millions will console her for her loss."
Feathers let her left eyelid droop briefly over her left eye.
"As for Esmeralda," resumed Feathers, "she tootled away on her flute to such effect that one of Ma Nelson's regulars, a gentleman in the theatrical profession whom she knew well,
chooses this aptest of moments to send a special messenger to say he'd fixed her up with an act in which she charms a snake out of a laundry basket. This snake, as it turns out, being a young man of handsome appearance and preternatural physical agility professionally known as the human eel. Esmeralda, appearing clad in a tiger skin and Greek sandals for this number. So hers turns out to be a magic flute, and this very artistic act has taught Britain and Europe to great applause. And this human eel soon contrives to wriggle his way into Esmeralda's affections to such an extent they've now a brace of little elves of their own, bless their hearts, to which Liz and I stood godmothers, sir.
We two were not left homeless either. Over the years, Feathers and I had put all our earnings and our tips into my sister's business, and there was a room ready and waiting for us with her. So there we decided to retreat, where we could recoil in order to jump better, as the French say. My sister is Otta. Best ice cream in London, sir. Best cassata outside Sicily. Old family recipe. Mio papa brought it with him. As for a bombe surprise...
Oops, interpolated Feathers, who at that moment by some accident had contrived to overturn her powder box. What a mess. It took a moment or two to dust the spilled powder off the things on the dressing table, and then it was she herself who continued. So all us girls was fixed up satisfactorily, and none of us got a wink of sleep that night, as we was all busy with planning and packing. Once our things were stowed away at last, we foregathered in the parlour to crack the last bottle of Ma Nelson's port that Esmeralda thoughtfully hid behind the fireguard when that demented minister bust in. How sad we were to say goodbye to one another, and to that room, the repository of so many bittersweet memories and humiliation and camaraderie, of whoring and sisterhood. And as for me, that room will ever be hallowed in my mind, since it was there I first released myself from gravity. We each took a little souvenir to remind us forever of stout-hearted Nelson.
Myself, said Lizzie, I took the French clock that always says midnight or noon.
For ain't it living proof that time stands still, sir? And Feathers opened her great eyes at him again, with such a swish of lashes that the pages of his notebook rustled in the breeze, even if, due to the lateness of the hour, the thick, shining whites of those eyes were now lightly streaked with red. That clock? You'll find it right there on the mantelpiece, for we never move an inch without it. What, I do declare! I must have tossed my knickers over it in my haste to dress for this evening's show, for it is quite hidden. She stretched one long arm across the room and twitched the voluminous drawers away from the very pretty, old-fashioned clock of her description, with Father Time on top and hands stuck at 12 for all eternity. Then dropped the drawers in a lacy heap on Walser's lap. The women chuckled a little as he removed them with tactful thumb and fingertips and laid them on the sofa behind him. But as for me, she said, I took my sword. Victory sword, the sword that started out its life on Nelson's thigh. She thrust her hand into the bosom of her dressing gown and brought forth a gilt sword, which then she flourished above her head. Although it was only the little toy sword of a full-dress admiral, it flashed and glittered in the exhausted light so sharply that Walser jumped. My sword. I carry it about all the time for reasons both of sentiment and self-protection. When she'd made sure he'd noticed what an edge it had, she replaced it in her bosom. At the end of the night, there we clustered like sad birds in that salon, and sipped our port and nibbled a bit of fruitcake Lizzie had put up for Christmas, but there was no point in keeping it. How sad, how chilly that room. We never bothered to light a fire after the funeral, so there was only a few nostalgic ashes of yesterday's sandalwood in the hearth. It was, remember this, and remember that, and Tin Our Jenny says, I say, why don't we open our curtains and let in a little light on the subject, since this is the last we shall see of this room? And the curtains had never been opened in all my memory of the place, nor could a single one of the other girls recall when those curtains had last been opened either. For with those drapes, there had been made the artificial night of pleasure, which was the perennial season of the salon. But now, with the mistress of the revels departed into darkness, it seemed only right and proper that we should give it all back to common day. So we threw open the curtains, and the shutters too, and then the tall window that opened above the melancholy river, from which came off a chill yet bracing wind.